Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we have some altruistic people to
very good, interesting
speak with.
People.
Yes, indeed. Carol Ledbetter from Plant a Row for the Hungry. They help you organize, basically. All that extra food from the garden doesn't need to just go to your neighbors, but with some organization, I can get to those who are more needy in our communities. Fresh vegetables, definitely something that some people go without. So you and your friends and your vegetable gardens can provide for them. Carol's got some details on how to get organized. And then Andrew Brown. He's the procurement manager for Habitat for Humanity's Restore, which is here in Louisville on Floyd Street. They mostly have a reputation for, what, hardware stuff, right, Bob?
Yeah.
Windows, doors. But now they're getting into plants.
It's a great program.
Yeah.
If you got some old plants.
New plants.
just give it to them. Yeah. They will sell it for a good cause.
That's right.
Everybody benefits.
Everybody does benefit, to be sure.
And speaking of benefits, there's a man named Marion T. Jackson who edited a book called The Natural Heritage of Indiana, which is just a marvelous study of everything you could ever want to know about Indiana and more.
Mm-hmm.
Birds, plants, trees, rocks, rivers, everything.
Past and present.
Yep. And yeah. Dr. Jackson will be with us to explain the natural heritage of Indiana.
Yeah. What, like 30... some odd different contributors, beautiful images. It just ties it all together so nicely.
And if you need a teaser, imagine 20 million acres of monster trees in Indiana.
It's really beautiful.
That's where it began.
Yeah, it is. So that's coming up today on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stay with us and support public radio as well. What's going on in your garden, Bob?
Quite literally, a Hidden Hill opens next weekend for the eighth amazing season, defying all capitalistic odds.
It's
by a long way.
Time of the year again.
Yeah, we're excited about it. It's just been fun to watch this thing grow and develop. It's almost
just
like a
ready
real...
for spring.
Yes, I am. So yeah. I'm looking forward to it. We're working hard, and it's going to be the best ever. So
good.
How about the Wish Estate?
And any plants that you have left over that you can't sell, where who are you going to give them?
They're
to?
They're going to go to Habitat for Humanity.
Restore.
Actually, that's a good idea.
Yeah. No, I'm going to be watching all my friends. in the nursery business.
My conscience.
That's right.
My redheaded conscience.
Although we often get dumpster plants and plant them out at the farm. I might have to share some of them with Habitat Restore.
I know.
I'll do that. I want you to, if you're interested, to check out our website, and you can monitor the progress of our chicken house that's being built inside the barn.
You gonna have pictures?
I have pictures right now, and my husband has started building our chicken house.
That's trouble.
With Lee... who's sort of the foreman. He's the one with the equipment and knows what he's doing. So he's showing, like, he helps basically do the hardcore stuff, right? And then tells us what we can do. And Andy's been assisting him as well. So far, it basically just looks like a stall inside of the barn. But I will continue to take pictures. The next step is Andy and I need to get the chicken wire up on the top part and then do some finishing work. And then we'll move outside to do the chicken yard area.
Whoa.
And I will document it as it unfolds and share our successes and failures with you.
And I'm going to come out and interview your chickens.
Okay, you can.
I know.
You'll be the, you guys will be
the Rhode
be benefiting.
Island Reds. Yeah, it'll be fun.
Benefiting from all the eggs I'll be bringing in to the radio station
as
well.
I hope so.
So, yes, I'm excited about that, and I'll keep everybody posted. Things going on around town in the springtime. Lots of people like to give trees away, plant trees, and the Belknap Neighborhood Association is partnering with the United Nations Environment Program, their 2008 billion tree campaign to give away trees. So if you want some trees, head out to Warham Park, which is 1832 Overlook Terrace, for the tree giveaway that's going to take place on April 5th. From 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., rain or shine. And, of course, more information on our website on that.
That's good.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah, what else, Bob?
Actually, it's faintly reminiscent of the Oklahoma land rush. Just sounds interesting. The Community Gardens, which is managed by the Jefferson County Cooperative Extension Service, is continuing open registration days for the community garden of your choice.
Okay.
You can go on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 10 until 2 p.m.
So show up at the garden.
To register for your garden or call 569-2344 or check our website.
There you go. And April 5th and 6th, the 21st annual Heart of Kentucky Farm and Home and Garden Show in Lebanon, Kentucky, there in Marion County, is going to take place. It's usually at the Tobacco Barns there, and I'll be there on Saturday if you want to come see me if you're down in that neck of the woods.
You going to bring your chickens?
I'll leave them at home.
Okay.
Right. But I might meet some chickens there. Yeah. Who knows? We'll see. But this person definitely is no chicken. She's been involved in some great programs, specifically the Plant a Row for the Hungry. Carol Ledbetter is joining us now. She administers the program in association with the Garden Writers Association and the Garden Foundation. Carol, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. First of all, let's just sort of get the basics of what exactly Plant a Row for the Hungry is and who started it.
Plant a Row for the Hungry began in 1995 in Anchorage, Alaska, of all places, in the garden column of Jeff Lowenfels, who is a former president of the Garden Writers Association, mm-hmm. when he asked gardeners to plant a row of vegetables for Beans Cafe, an Anchorage soup kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And then it became a national program in 1999 and has spread throughout the country
mm-hmm.
and Canada. And to date, we've tracked nearly 12 million pounds of fresh produce that has been donated for the Plant a Row program all over the country. That is a lot of food for the needy people in your area.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm sure there are numbers of pounds that have not been reported that have been donated to local food agencies.
Well, Carol, how many states are involved now? Are all 50 states on board here?
No, we don't have all 50 states. I would say that we probably have 45 states.
Close enough.
Mm-hmm.
And then how do you
involved.
I'm sorry. How do you help people get organized? How do I get my tomatoes from my garden to a needy food kitchen somewhere?
Well, people can participate on a number of levels. One, they can participate as an individual. They can donate fresh produce to a local food agency in their community. I can help people with that because they can contact my phone number, 877-492-2727, and I can help them find a place locally where they can take their fresh produce.
Mm-hmm.
We have groups that work together as an entire community. We have church groups involved. We have master gardener groups involved, school groups, or community garden groups.
Mm-hmm.
And they organize and get a group of people together to make these pounds count. And I can help by providing a Plant a Row workbook and press kit that we've developed, which gives a lot of ideas on how to proceed in organizing a local campaign.
Mm-hmm.
We also provide marketing brochures and some small row markers or tea stakes that people can place in their garden. And these marketing brochures would help to promote the program and introduce people to the Plant a Row program.
Okay, are there particular plants you'd like to see grown, tomatoes, potatoes, easy-to-grow veggies as opposed to more sophisticated?
That would vary from region to region. Most people have tomatoes, but the best thing to do is to contact a local food agency and find out what kind of vegetables they would like.
So it sounds pretty easy then, Carol. Folks can contact you if they need some help in getting, some organization perhaps?
Yes, absolutely.
And connecting.
This workbook and press kit will give them great ideas, and
okay.
Everyone can get involved.
Uh-huh.
Like I say, as individuals, a community, it's a great program to help the needy in your own community.
Great. Sounds good.
Sure does.
Everybody always has extra squash by the middle of the summer, right?
Absolutely.
I'm hoping.
All right.
And after a while, your neighbors say, oh, no more zucchini, no more squash.
Exactly. So we'll make sure we see some Plant a Row for the Hungry's initiative start up here in our area, because we don't have any in the Louisville area, do we?
No, you do not, and
okay.
You need something there.
All right. There's a call to action,
yep.
Louisville. Thank you so much, Carol. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Carol Ledbetter administers Plant a Row for the Hungry through the Garden Foundation, a nonprofit that was established by the Garden Writers Association so they could expand the program. And now we're going to take a look at another really great program that's got some local roots. We don't have any Plant a Row for the Hungry here in Louisville yet, but we definitely have a strong Habitat for Humanity presence. But also Habitat for Humanity has a store basically called Restore, and Andrew Brown is joining us now. He's procurement manager for our local Restore, where they recycle building materials, and now they're looking to partner with local nurseries to recycle plants as well, which is a great idea. And we want to welcome Andrew to the show.
Oh, thank you guys very much. Uh-huh. I appreciate the exposure.
Let's talk about how Habitat for Humanity Restore actually works.
Well, what we are is we're a wholly owned subsidiary of Habitat for Humanity in Metro Louisville, and we operate as a retail environment. So we take donations from three sources, donations from people's residences, my job, which is to solicit commercial donations, and we also have a deconstruction program that salvages materials from teardowns.
Okay. And typically, we think about Habitat for Humanity building homes, that sort of thing. So in its traditional form, Restore really had to do with like building materials, right? But you're branching off to something a little bit different now.
Yeah, it was the program's been around, I think, for 12 years. The first one down to Texas, and it was just another way to help further the mission of helping, you know, families in need. So mm-hmm. just it started as a development source of money, but still keeping with the mission and using donated stuff.
Who shops at Restore? Just anybody looking for a good deal on a door?
Well, we get a lot of our biggest customer base is probably investment property owners and people, first-time homeowners.
Okay. And where are you located and what are your hours?
We're at 2777 South Floyd Street. We're open from 10 to 6 on Tuesday through Friday and 10 to 4 on Saturdays.
And you get into plants now. You're rescuing plants and restoring those and reselling them.
That's correct. Last year, the first year we were open, we kind of had a dead summer. And then the second year, we decided to try something new. So we went after some plants. And we found one of the mega box retailers to sell us their losers for very cheap. And then we get everything from just wrinkled leaves to, you know, circling the drain. And we tease and deadhead and water them back to life and sell them to the public.
So you're getting in my way, buddy.
Yeah, have you gotten any full donations? Certainly Bob knows, being in the nursery business himself, there are certain times of the year that some folks are just throwing out plants because they've got to make room for new stuff coming in, annuals. Have you made any contact with smaller local nurseries that are willing to give you their otherwise dumpster plants?
Yeah, we've had some really good donations last year from Wallach, and this year Matthew Gardner at Boone Gardner has raised awareness about our program within the Louisville Nursery Association.
Okay.
And they have a sustainable gardening contingent to their nursery called the Turning a New Leaf, I think it is. And and that speaks to the same things we're doing at Restore and keeping things out of the landfills.
Mm-hmm. So how are customers responding to the availability of plants?
They love it. They swarm us. Last year we'd have they'd pull up the truck and we basically had to unload them in under cover of night or very early in the morning because before we got them priced, people, you know, would be there looking for that new plant.
And how are your prices in comparison to other retailers?
We generally price things at half of retail or less. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's going to be really dependent on the quality of the plant. If they're going to need a lot of love, we're not going to make you pay as much for, you know, a fairly healthy.
There's something really beautiful
specimen.
About that.
Cool. Now, how does the process work? You get several thousand plants that need help, and then you help them. But take us through that.
Well, we would get them off the truck there, and that's when our dedicated volunteers would take over. We've got a woman who just finished the Master Gardener program, Marty Essing, and she takes the lead on that. Thank you, Marty. And we do a triage. We decide which ones are going to need the most love, and then give them that attention, and then let the others take care of themselves. And we teach our volunteers how to take care of it, and we're going to try to do that this year with Marty, teaching people how to take care of plants, how to rescue them.
So does everybody get a chance, or are there occasions where a little plant in a pot doesn't quite make the triage cut.
Oh. Well, you know, we do everything we possibly can. If it's if it's DOA, we you know, we respectfully dispose of it.
And Janine and I have never lost a plant in our lives.
Oh,
I want you to know that.
Oh no. So clearly you're interested in drumming up some more relationships with nurseries.
Yes, of course.
Are we talking about perennial plants? Are we talking about annuals? Are we talking about woodies, shrubs, trees?
Anything goes.
Anything goes.
Anything goes.
You also acquire plants in different. In a couple of other different ways as well.
Yes, you know, last year we took we participated in the getting rid of the Philip Morris building, the deconstruction there, and we dug up the hostas and divided those and put them into pots. So, you know, if you know any of you gardeners are out there driving around and you see a diesel cat in front of a building there,
getting ready to demolish it.
Yeah, so we can actually, you know, utilize those materials and, you know, again, keeps it out of the landfill, keeps a, you know, a beautiful and a sustainable resource, you know, on the planet and helps out habitat partner families.
And I'm guessing the greatest challenge you have is you don't know what you're going to get when, and customers have to call or drive by slowly twice a day or what?
Right. We would prefer you drive by slowly simply because, you know, we work with volunteers and everybody has to know a little bit something about, you know, not just plants, but toilets and doors and carpet. And so we don't know exactly what's out there. That's why we rely on our dedicated volunteers to, you know, we can say we have a tree and we have some green stuff and some flowery stuff, but, you know, the treasure and the fun is coming to hunt for it.
All right. So you're on Floyd?
Floyd, that's right. We're
Floyd
right
Street.
Across from Gate 1, Papa John's Stadium.
All right.
So that's a good marker.
Okay. Right. So if you are a business, if you are an individual, if you are a nursery that either's about to demolish your garden out front, or you're about to throw something in the dumpster, call Andrew Brown at Habitat Restore because they will be interested in triaging your plants.
And can you pick up plants if necessary?
That's right. We have a pickup service for businesses. It's absolutely free. Just give us a call at 636-2419 and schedule that pickup, and we'll come get it.
This is a great program.
It is a great program, and we'll have all the details on our website at WFPL.org. Andrew, thanks so much for coming
in.
We appreciate it.
Again.
Thank you.
Andrew Brown is procurement manager for our local Habitat for Humanity Restore, where they recycle building materials and are now looking to partner with local nurseries to recycle plants, too. Instead of things heading to the dumpster, consider contacting Habitat for Humanity instead. And, of course, for more information, please see our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Marion Jackson in his book, The Natural Heritage of Indiana. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
This is Bob Hill, moving on from hungry people to habitat to Hoosiers.
There we go.
As predicted earlier in the show, we're going to speak with a man who knows more about Indiana than anybody else I think I've ever read about.
Marion Jackson has edited this beautiful book. The book's it's in its third printing. Is that right, Bob?
Something like that, yeah.
Every state would be lucky to have a book like this put together about its natural heritage from, you know, plant ecology to wildlife to, you know, wetlands and forest, everything. It's just a beautiful book, and Marion Jackson's here to talk to us a little bit about how he put it together.
Yep. Marion Jackson is a professor emeritus of ecology at Indiana State University and former chairman of the Indiana chapter of the Nature Conservancy. He's author of 101 Trees of Indiana, a guide by Indiana Press, but he's here today to talk about another Indiana Press book, The Natural Heritage of Indiana. Marion, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you.
You've just written a fabulous book here. I was curious at first if you're a native Hoosier, or was it an acquired taste for you to become a Hoosier?
No, I was born and raised here. My family goes way back to settlement days, I guess. I grew up in Ripley County near a little town of Versailles.
And then your book, The Natural Heritage of Indiana, it's kind of a mammoth task, 500 pages, 500 photos, charts, graphs, landscape, vegetation, natural terrain, birds, animals, preservation. How do you begin a project like that?
The initial idea was formulated by a number of us in Indiana from the Indiana Academy of Science, the Department of Natural Resources, several of the colleges and universities and so forth, who felt that we ought to have a book that summarized a lot of the natural features of Indiana. And so back in the late 80s, I guess it was, that we had our first meetings and worked up a tentative outline and so forth.
And it took you how long to get the first edition out?
Well, it was almost 10 years from the time we had our first meeting until the book actually was in print, and part of that was because we had to coordinate so many different authors and seek photographs that were suitable and all this sort of thing, and just to coordinate it and bring it all along at the same time and the same pace was quite a chore.
Yeah, it begins with an image that most people don't have of Indiana in the early 1700s. 20 million acres of forest, 2 million acres of prairie, 3 million acres of wetlands and barrens. You just can't imagine Indiana with 20 million acres of forest. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I'm sure the forest wasn't entirely unbroken. I'm sure there were openings in it and so forth. But it was essentially all original timber. And in the some sites, you know, of course, the trees were smaller and more scattered. But this must have just been a magnificent hardwood forest. I believe the hardwood forest of eastern North America is the finest hardwood forest ever in recent geologic times anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm. The trees 3 and 4 feet in diameter, thousands of them.
Yes, oh yes, I think those were fairly routine, and some of them went much larger than that. There are records in the lower Wabash River Valley of trees 8, 9, and 10 feet in diameter.
Oh, my gosh.
And some of them approach 200 feet tall. Their actual measurements of trees 190 feet or even perhaps 200.
It's amazing. Some of the photographs are amazing, too, to see those large trees. It's see, like when you look at the book, Indiana has it all, or had it all.
Right.
The hardwood forest, the prairie, the wetlands, different types of geology. It seems like the Ice Age and the glaciers molded the state more than anything else in its diversity. Can we take a snapshot look at the Ice Age and its impact on the state before we look at sort of its more contemporary incarnations?
Yes, without question, various ice advances probably modified the landscape of Indiana more than any single feature. And this occurred over a few hundred thousand years, and most of the impact that occurred in the last few 10,000 years is what really changed the nature of Indiana. It relocated rivers, for example. The Ohio River was not where it is presently. It flows along the southern margin of the glacial advance, essentially.
Uh-huh.
And much of central Indiana was essentially plained flat in the wonderful agricultural region of central part of Indiana. And the hilly parts of southern Indiana were either lightly glaciated or escaped glaciation at all. So,
okay,
what was here when the settlers came was largely a product of the ice, certainly.
Mm-hmm. And even the geological, like the beneath the soil, if you look to the north, you've got very sandy soils and the dunes, and then southern Indiana is completely different. Is that all kind of a part of the glaciation as well?
It was greatly influenced by that.
Okay.
See, the glacier brought tremendous amounts of material from farther north in Michigan and in Canada and up that way. And this is then what the vegetation started growing on and molded this glacial material into the soils of Indiana. So it had a great influence on the soils of the state as well.
Yeah, we care a lot here about the falls of the Ohio because Louisville is here because it was the only impediment between Pittsburgh and the Mississippi River. Can you talk a little bit about how the falls were formed and why they survived while the rest of the river was wider and broader and deeper?
Well, there's a bedrock fairly near the surface there. I'm not a geologist, and I only know from secondhand information what was going on there. But this was an area of bedrock that was near the surface, and of course the river was forced to flow over that bedrock and didn't carve it deeper like much of the other channel. And this is an area where, as I understand it, the bison would come across.
Right. Oh, okay.
Indiana.
Right.
And then they would cross at the falls of the Ohio into Kentucky.
So that was their bridge, so to speak.
Exactly.
Speaking of bison, another component to the book is the wildlife of the state, from prehistoric animals that are now extinct to those that we see today. What's the diversity of wildlife?
Most of the species of animals did survive in Indiana, except, you know, for the large forms. Most of the bird species that were here originally and most of the smaller mammals and so forth, they did survive, although they're greatly reduced in numbers and the extent of their range. But many of the really large animals, of course, became extinct largely through the activity of the settlers. Even the deer were completely eliminated. I would tell my students that I can remember when there were essentially no deer in the state of Indiana, and they thought I was spinning some kind of a big yarn because deer are so common now. But the elk were here. They were wiped out. There were bison abundantly in northwestern Indiana particularly. They were completely eliminated. And the large predators like the wolf and the black bear and the cougar were all eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
Even the wild turkey was completely eliminated and was reintroduced. So we have most of the smaller farms, but several of the large farms were completely eliminated.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Jackson, is that sort of the point at which we look at the before and the after, that point of settlement? You know, what Indiana was like before settlement, what Indiana was like after settlement. So clearly that means that settlement was the thing that precipitated the most change.
Yes, I think without question. And I don't think we should fault the settlers for what they did. It was their way of earning a livelihood.
Sure.
And the trees were a tremendous impediment. They had to be eliminated in order to create farms and homesteads and so forth. And so I think if we were doing over again what they did, we probably would do the same thing, just as a matter of survival.
Mm-hmm.
But they certainly had an incredible impact on the state in terms of forest clearing, draining of wetlands. They plowed the prairies and, of course, built the settlements and the cities and all of this. So they had the greatest impact of anything on the landscape.
So as the prairies disappeared and as the wetlands disappeared, what started to happen to everything else in terms of ecology?
Well, when they drained the wetlands, this increased the extent of flooding. Flooding was more prevalent because the wetlands used to absorb most of the rainfall and then release it slowly, you know, during the dry seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And after they lowered the water table in the soils and so forth, the water ran off much more rapidly. And I think we had floods in pre-settlement times, but they weren't as extensive or as common as they certainly are today, or certainly before we started putting flood control projects into effect.
Well, Doctor, let's talk some about what's left. I mean, you discuss in your book the Heritage Program and what's being saved in Indiana, but let's begin by saying, we went to the Barrens a few years ago, but are there any natural areas left that, as they were 200 years ago, except for a few barrens here and there?
Surprisingly, there's quite a few. Most of them are small, and I've been active in natural area preservation for most of my 40-year career, and we didn't really think there was very much left at all when we first started preservation activity, but we found more bits and pieces than we originally realized. And now we have, I believe it's around 230 dedicated state nature preserves where nature is reasonably intact. And it's, you know, resembles what was here originally, although the pieces are awfully small in most cases.
Are they all hidden? Are we allowed to go see?
Yeah.
By definition, I think.
Well, these are fairly well publicized. Occasionally, they're described in Outdoor Indiana and other magazines and in newspaper articles and so forth. And there's a division of nature preserves, and that's their main charge, is to find and protect and manage and preserve bits and pieces of Indiana as it once was.
And how would people living in the Louisville area, southern Indiana area, find these places?
Well, they put out a directory of nature preserves. You could write to them or email them, and they have lists that they make available, and people can visit them. Some of them, there are restrictions on visitation because they're so small and so sensitive that they just can't stand the impact, you know. But these are open to the public for the most part, and in fact, they invite people to hike the trails and visit these and help protect them and so forth.
Well, that's marvelous. It's just a terrific book, and we encourage listeners to go buy it, and even Kentuckians, because
yes.
You just learn a lot about it. I mean, this didn't stop at the Ohio River. There's a lot of this comes across into Kentucky also, I think, a lot of what you write about and talk about. So thank you for what you've done and all you do.
Yes. Thank you, Doctor.
Oh, you're certainly welcome.
Marion Jackson is Professor Emeritus of Ecology at Indiana State University and editor of the book, The Natural Heritage of Indiana. For more information on Dr. Jackson or the book, visit the Homegrown page at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, we've got some questions from listeners in a new chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With questions.
We have some questions, and we have time for one.
How about that? We'll do it properly, however.
All right. Courtney. Hi, Bob and Janine. I caught the tail end of your program today, so I have to write. Here's my question. 2 years ago, during fall, I was directed to cut back all of my perennials so as to promote growth for next spring. I did just that. However, when spring arrived, 7 months later, everything slowly came back except my gorgeous hydrangeas. I have now been told that I should have left them alone, obviously a novice move on my part. I had zero blooms all summer, and this is an endless summer hydrangea. I hope you can find the humor here. So she's wondering what to do. This fall, she said she touched nothing, no pruning. What can she expect this spring and summer? Is her hope for huge blooms a realistic one?
Yes, in her case, it is. It certainly is. And it's the dreaded hydrangea question, because there is no one way for hydrangeas. There's many different kinds. Some you cut back in the spring and some you don't. But in her case, the endless summer, which is a macrophylla, is one that normally blooms on the previous season's wood. However, the endless summer genetically predisposed to bloom on new wood also.
Yes, it is. But last year, too, was an exceptionally odd year because of that late freeze we had.
Right.
So even if you hadn't cut it back, a lot of people didn't have their endless summers bloom just because the wacky weather.
And then
we had a drought, too, remember. So if you did get blooms, you ended up getting them really, really, really late in the summer.
October.
I have a general rule, and this is sort of like a new rule, Bob, when it comes to hydrangeas.
I'm taking notes.
Don't cut hydrangeas back, no matter what they are, until spring arrives and everything leaves out and you can tell what's dead and what's not, and then you can do some cleaning. Because oak leaf hydrangeas don't ever really need pruning. The hydrangea macrophylla, the species that's the endless summer, they do need pruning from time to time to keep them kind of vigorous and healthy, but you don't want to prune away the old stuff like you were talking about.
Right.
Extra old stuff, yes, but not old stuff from last year. Annabelles can be cut back to the ground every year or not and still be fine. So can the paniculatas. So, you know, it's that tricky sort of confusion reigns. So don't do anything is my philosophy until spring arrives.
Although my annabelles and paniculatas will get real big and leggy. So eventually
you can still wait until spring. That's my point.
That's a good point.
So it supports your philosophy as well.
Well, I'd hope so.
So patience sometimes might be your best bet when it comes to hydrangeas. She has one last little question. How do you eradicate poison ivy successfully? And my two tips are to grub it out, meaning cut it out with a spade, and then anything that comes back, hit it with a herbicide like Brush Be Gone or Roundup, and you have to be persistent.
Exactly.
Ditto.
Exactly.
All right, Bob, how can people get a hold of us if they have a question?
Visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 814-8246.
It's a plant story day, Bob.
It
what
is.
Do you have for us? Something delightfully creative and hopefully something inspiring to spring.
How did you know?
I was just keeping my fingers crossed because I'm getting desperate for spring.
It's all of the above.
Okay.
Actually, I picked this plant because I like it as much as the mysterious name, but it's the bleeding heart, which is, of course, both a flower and someone who watches CNN and votes for liberal Democrats.
That's why I don't have fancy TV.
It's, it's almost an extinct species, actually. Gets its name, obviously, from the distinctive kind of heart-shaped flowers that hang above this delicate gray-green,
it's beautiful
blue-green foliage. I just love it.
I do, too.
And it's best grown in fertile, humus-rich soil, does well in shaded woodland area. I didn't know this. It'll do fairly well in the sun if it's kept watered.
Right.
I've always kind of hid mine in the shade, so I didn't know that.
I think they get just more robust, and kind of the clump gets really big if they get a little sun.
And I'm going to try that this year, actually.
So morning sun, try that.
Okay, here's a little quiz in the middle of this thing.
Okay.
Its Latin name is D-I-C-E-N-T-R-A. How do you pronounce that?
Dicentra.
Actually, it's Dicentra. All these years, I did not know that. Yeah, but it makes sense.
Why would C-I be K?
I'll explain it to you.
Okay.
The di part is the Greek for two,
and
kentra comes from the Greek kentron.
So it's Greek, not
K-E-N-T-R-O-N, meaning spur.
Okay.
Two-spurred. So it's dikentra.
Which the heart flowers have the little
two. Yeah, you
can
knock them dead and you know that now.
Uh-huh.
Folk names are Lady's Locket, Lyre Flower, and Lady in the Bath. This is cool.
Ooh.
Because if you turn it upside down and pull back the little petals, there'll be a tiny figure in a bathtub. I didn't know that.
I'll try that.
Yeah. Hmm. The best of them is the one you talked about, the Dicentra spectabilis, which is that big, spectacular, rosy red and pink white one. I just love it, yeah. Tough old plant, first discovered in Siberia in 1810, taken to England in 1846, came across the United States later on by a man named Robert Fortune, Fortunii.
Right.
He also brought us the winter jasmine and the honeysuckle.
He brought us a ton of stuff, too.
Yeah,
good and bad, huh, if it was
absolutely.
The winter honeysuckle.
Another thing people don't realize, you think of the pink dicentra. There's an Adrian bloom, which is raspberry red.
Mm-hmm.
Snowdrift is white.
Mm-hmm.
Langtrees is creamy white with pink. Scandens, which I've grown, is yellow. And Zestful is a deep rose. Then there's a gold heart I don't like. It's got bright gold leaves.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a school bus. I mean,
yeah.
I don't like it at all.
Or sick.
Yeah, they got to be pink.
Yeah.
Or red anyway.
Yeah.
Comes with a poem. Gardens are best served without politics. Horticulture and hot air rarely mix. So let's change the subject from the start and speak only well of this bleeding heart. A springtime charmer we hate to leave, its heart so out there on its sleeve, all sweet and demure on the garden path, while concealing a lady in her bath.
Mm-hmm.
An elegant plant with long arching branches and gray-green foliage that sways and dances. A spectacular plant for arboretum or home, worthy of praise, our love, and a poem.
Very nice. But you know what? I may have a hard time retraining myself in terms of the pronunciation of Dicentra.
I know.
So,
me too. It's like clematis and clematis.
Right.
Say Dicentra and people will think you're wrong.
They'll think that I'm crazy.
Yeah.
Although they may think that already, though, huh? Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, you won't want to miss it because we're going to find out what to expect with the 2008 emergence of Brood 14 of the 17-year cicadas.
Homegrown is produced by the often hungry Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.